Well, welcome to the eighth and alas the last in this series of Darwin College lectures on the theme of life. As I said at the beginning, what we're trying to do, what we've been trying to do, is exploring the boundary of life and non-life, and I guess we're ending up with how humanity has conceived of non-life. The subject is the afterlife. And we're ending, in a sense, at the beginning with an authority on the archaeology of human origins. Our speaker's Clive Gamble. He's professor of archaeology at Southampton, with partial interludes to Royal Holloway. That's where he's been a long time. He was educated and trained as an archaeologist here in Cambridge, and his work has been on the origins of social life in Paleolithic Europe, and I suppose the emergence of human identity, insofar as one can identify it. How far does the emergence of self-awareness necessitate notions of non-life? How and why did humanity develop the really, when you look at it, rather extraordinary hypothesis of an afterlife? It will now be explained.
Master, thank you very much indeed, ladies and gentlemen. When asked about what happens next, Woody Allen replied, "I don't believe in an afterlife, although I am bringing a change of underwear." Such preparedness goes to the heart of understanding attitudes to the afterlife. Leave nothing to chance was the advice taken by ancient Egyptians who could afford a Book of the Dead to be buried with them, even though the book factory where they bought it often misspelt their names. The words, it seemed, didn't matter so much as the possession of the object. As a sat-nav to the future, such devices could never be properly tested or returned as faulty, and many purchasers probably got stuck on the equivalent of a bridge that was too narrow in the netherworld of the dead. Nonetheless, the book, which contained some 200 spells, had a long shelf life, enjoying a period of popularity between 1550 and 1069 BC. It acted to overcome the dangers of the netherworld, which were many, and through which the dead person walked, floated on air, or travelled by boat. Clearly the inspiration for today's gaming industry, the many levels and dangers that the dead person encountered, were overcome by the special powers of the spells that transformed them into a variety of animals and plants, and by transforming, they triumphed until they reached their goal and the two words that await us all at the end of all things, game over. Or, as Bob Dylan, using updated Egyptian references, puts it, "Oh, mama, can this really be the end, to be stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again?" Now, as an archaeologist, I could provide you with an historical account of the many and varied beliefs in the afterlife. I could range across the cultures of the world, digging into the temporal archives to recover nuggets of information that would delight and intrigue, and which gathered together forms a facet of its creator's afterlife, read, transformed, and remembered. But I'm not going to do that in this lecture. Instead, I want to approach the afterlife as a geographer, which was my affiliation when I was first asked to participate in this Darwin lecture series. From that perspective, I'll view the afterlife as a landscape that has cognitive, social, and aesthetic properties comparable to any other. I will argue that the afterlife is an imaginary geography, no different in principle to Alice's Wonderland or James Cameron's Pandora. Edward Said, who famously dissected Orientalism with the concept, maintained that there's no doubt that imaginative geography and history help the mind to intensify its own sense of itself by dramatizing the distance and difference between what is close to it and what is far away. Said's observation points us in the direction I want to take. The afterlife is a creative exercise, and one that stems from a basic dramatic property of the mind and the spatial mechanisms by which we construct an identity, a sense of self. However, I'll argue for a different understanding of the mind than one which allows it to intensify its own sense of itself. The mind as something inside our heads intensifies nothing, especially itself. On the contrary, according to George Lakoff and Mark Johnson, cognitive science has demonstrated the following: that the mind is inherently embodied, thought is mostly unconscious, and abstract concepts are largely metaphorical. As an archaeologist, I'd go further still. The mind is an embodied, extended artifact distributed widely through materials, objects, and other identities, rather than simply contained in the skull or networked in neurons. It's both rational and relational, which means that it depends on context and emotional engagement to make sense of the information it receives, the associations it fashions, and the geographies it peoples. An extended mind is an inclusive project combining the materials encountered in the world, the body's chemically based emotions, and its interior thoughtscapes. Now, it's these combinations that achieve Said's amplification, and the outcome has indeed been to dramatize the distant and the strange by conjuring our imagination. Therefore, in order to understand the landscape of the afterlife, we need to investigate why humans have such a capacity for imagination. Why is it that we use metaphor and symbol to structure our lives, including those in the past and the one to come, in an imaginative rather than strictly empirical way? Moreover, I don't believe that during our evolution over 6 million years, we have always had this exaggerated capacity. How and when it evolved is of interest because of the underlying principles rather than the pursuit of afterlife beliefs for their own sake. Consequently, I'll argue that human imagination emerged as a property of social life long before there were books of the dead, visions of heaven and hell, and the Memphis Blues. Here I'll focus on the deep history of humans, when the heavy evolutionary lifting was done, and where the realms of the cognitive and social became entangled with those of the material and the aesthetic. I'll also focus on a time 600,000 years ago as the tipping point in hominin human evolution for these realms. And this is a graph of increasing brain size from 2.5 million years ago to the present day. The line is still optimistically going upwards. This is the point of inflection, which I think is terribly interesting at the moment in human evolution, around about 600,000 years ago, when we start to have this hockey stick move upwards in brain size and with large-brained hominins. Now, I've used this word hominin, so I better just explain hominins. We have these three words in human evolution: hominids, hominins, and humans. And this explains it. Everybody in this slide is a hominid. That's chimpanzees, our fossil ancestors in the middle here, and myself. Hominin then refers to our fossil ancestors. This is Neanderthal, and this is someone with a very low forehead from about 2 million years ago, and myself. But humans, of course, is solely restricted to myself, and of course, everybody in this room and everyone else on this planet. Now, the hominin capacity to think outside the box, to go beyond the immediate world where interaction is mediated by the senses, is one of our defining capacities. We are not the only animal either to think forward or to draw on past experience, but we are the only animal to take it to such social extremes. This is the concept of going beyond the here and now, to imagine either the activities of others who, though alive, are not present before us, or an ancestor who lives in our memories, among us, but not with us. To go beyond implies a distributed cognition that extends us across time and space. Such cognition involves not just living equivalents, but the material networks in which we are enmeshed and without which we would be very different social beings. Now, this has long been recognized. In 1759, Adam Smith argued in The Theory of Moral Sentiments that our imagination is the key to our capacity for sympathy. In what today might be called a theory of mind, and I'll come back to this concept later, Smith declared that we have no immediate experience of what other men feel. By the imagination, we place ourselves in his situation. So materials and the senses, which are the core resources of the human social experience, are central to that human capacity of going beyond. Now, the imaginative capacity for extension has been identified as central to understanding human social life by disciplines that have different approaches to the issue. Tony Giddens, for example, defines one of the principal questions for social theory as follows, and I quote, "How the limitations of individual presence are transcended by the stretching of social relations across time and space." Now, the same issue, but in different vocabulary, emerges for primatologists, and where going beyond the information available before you to construct society is a feature of human social cognition. And in a comparison of human and primate communities, a team of behavioral ecologists recognized the importance in the social life of the former of uncoupling relationships from the constraints of co-presence, what they term the release from proximity, which of course is something which all of us in this room do without even thinking about it. We have a social life that doesn't just depend on what's in front of our eyes or what's assailing our senses. Our primate heritage requires that we construct social bonds on the basis of personal interaction, and where their strength derives from the emotional legacy involved in such encounters. But notoriously, we go beyond this flesh and blood intimacy to stretch those bonds when partners are absent, and to confer equal status to surrogate. Now, for me, this sense was captured perfectly for the Facebook generation, where we all live apart and just occasionally meet, by the Greek poet Palladas, who lived in Alexandria during the 4th century AD, and he brought together this idea of the materiality of living apart. And this is the Tony Harrison translation. "Loving the rituals that keep men close, nature created means for friends apart. Pen, paper, ink, the alphabet, signs for the distant and disconsolate heart." As a result, we can maintain equally intense relationships with artifacts such as sports cars, smartphones, and family pets. And here we have the basic building blocks of creating social interaction, the grooming amongst primates, which we do quite a bit of as well, the intense emotional bonds between mother and children, the basic dyad of society, and the love-struck gaze over here. Of course, once we introduce objects into this, the situation changes a bit, and we suddenly find that motor cars become a focus, and the family dog, and we notice that phones and laptops seem to have an equally intense gaze. And in a recent study that was widely reported in the British press in August last year, there were claims that 18% of the women surveyed spent more time talking to their dog than their husband or boyfriend. I rest my case. The achievement of hominins has been twofold. First, we've been able to amplify the bonds of social life so that they have the power to condition interaction in absentia when you're not there. Second, we have enfolded into our social universes the agency of inanimate materials and non-human organisms. Long derided as symptomatic of the primitive mind, the practice of animism, magic, sorcery, taboo, and totem enshrine an understanding suppressed in our own scientific culture of the power of things. Such agency, as anthropologist Alfred Gell pointed out, is a different form of agency to that between two hominin actors. But so long as objects, animate or inanimate, are implicated in networks of social relations, then they are both the source of and target for agency. And if agency is an expression of our capacity for social life, then this is scaffolded around the core of materials and senses. Materials and emotions here lying at the heart of our social experience. And the dotted line here is, if you like, the scaffold. Or if you want to put it another way, it's like the energizer battery that's inside the white rabbit of human imagination. Now, understanding the hominin capacity for imagination that transcends quotidian life and people's fabulous landscapes, such as the Netherworld or Michael Jackson's Neverland, is therefore as much a material as a mental process. It depends on thoughts and things and the relationships drawn between them in the many and varied social contexts. These landscapes are both symbolic and metaphoric, rich in signs and substitutes, but also grounded in sensory experience. When seeking the appearance of hominin imagination, archaeologists have stressed the discovery of objects as signs. These are highly varied, ranging from some tracery on animal bones, here 400,000 years ago, to the appearance that seemed to be more like more intentional rather than just the aspect of defleshing something to get the meat. And this varies also to objects of identity, such as adornment, gifts, and burials. And on the right there is what a well-dressed Neanderthal was wearing 40,000 years ago. These are the earliest signs of symbolism and much debated and very controversial in themselves. The paucity and profusion of such objects in different regions and at different times in the world of the Old Stone Age sparks controversy over the location, antiquity, and markers of these. And moving forward just a little bit, no one has any doubt that these are symbolic artifacts, and in fact, it's not difficult to see what was on the minds of the people who made them. The aim is to demonstrate when and where the potential for so-called behavioral modernity arose, as indicated by these symbols, and whether, to move to the theme of the lecture, whether the hominins, like Neanderthals, were prepared for an afterlife with such simple burials as the one on the left, or whether it's humans, like everyone in this room, with more elaborate burials as the one on the right. Who is prepared for the afterlife? Who has monopolies on symbols and this behavioral modernity? Now, I must confess that I've grown rather weary of this debate and the endless claims and counterclaims. Neither do I really understand what behavioral modernity actually means. Can symbols only exist if they are made material? Could there ever have been a time when hominins had no symbols? Colin Renfrew, for example, has suggested there was a time in the Paleolithic when there were symbols but no modernity. Did that come later, perhaps in the Neolithic, when people were now densely packed in villages and towns, farming the fields around? Urbanism concentrated minds wonderfully. The result was an explosion of human imagination and imaginary geographies. The problem is that signs and symbols can be readily identified linguistically, but remain opaque when it comes to objects. We are left trying to determine the symbolic intentions of someone 600,000 years ago holding a bone in one hand and a flint tool in the other. What we are being asked to accept or reject is a rational account where the author of the scratches that I showed you on that large bone deliberately chose between a symbolic and a non-symbolic gesture to depict. But how can a decision like that ever be made? How could one act depiction be more symbolic than another defleshing a bone? That type of inquiry is beyond archaeology, not because the evidence cannot survive, but because it supposes a universal cognitive process identical to our own. That process makes familiar distinctions between categories such as sacred and profane, symbolic and mundane, person and thing. Cognition is separated from the world rather than extended into it. An alternative is to switch the vocabulary away from symbol and towards metaphor. The basis of metaphor is that we experience one thing in terms of another. As a result, the embodiment of our senses becomes important in the way metaphors derive their meaning. Instead of a semiotic approach where signs and symbols are interrogated for their significance, the opportunity presented by metaphor is to return the senses to the study of relational knowledge. Furthermore, while semiotics is essentially a study based on our capacity for language and then applied to objects, a metaphorical approach draws on linguistic, material, and musical sources. These three sources for metaphor can be highly nuanced and entangled. Let me give you an example. Many metaphors arise from our experience of being contained, enfolded. For example, simple phrases like, I'm in a jam, or to be stuck inside of Mobile, or as Winston Churchill famously said, Russia is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. Now, many material metaphors are also containers. The tattoos on our skin, containers. The clothes we wear, the drums we beat, the houses we live in, the presents we wrap to exchange, and the hearths we sit around, as shown here, are all containers and material metaphors of that experience of containment. And solid metaphors dominate our contemporary culture. We are a culture, if nothing else, of containers. They have done that since the container explosion of pots, bags, and baskets that appeared with the first farming, displacing the instrument, such as a spear or knife, as the favored material metaphor. The dominant way of thinking through objects has also permeated concepts. How could there be kinship categories without a notion of containment, or the institutions of the state that enfold the citizen? Therefore, the realignment from a focus on symbols to an interest in metaphors has immediate payoffs for considering the evolution of hominin imagination, that prerequisite for an afterlife. Archaeologists have a clear answer to that question. Which came first, linguistic or material metaphors? Things, solid metaphors, preceded words and linguistic symbols. As recently as 1.5 million years ago, hominins, such as the Narikotomi boy from West Turkana in Kenya, had developed bipedal walking and the capability even for endurance running. These Homo erectus hominins also made symmetrical stone implements, shown here at the bottom, material metaphors that took the form of instruments, extensions of the limb and the hand. However, a study of Narikotomi's hypoglossal canal preserved in his vertebra shows that he lacked fine muscle control over his tongue. Consequently, he was unable to control his breathing to produce the significant pauses in speech production that contribute to language. That came later, and certainly by 600,000 years ago, when large-brained hominins were widespread across the settled portion of the Old World. Now, the size of the brain is more important than the detail of the faces of these early hominins. As shown by Leslie Aiello and Robin Dunbar for apes and monkeys, the larger the brain, the larger personal network sizes of an individual. They started doing this work by looking at primate communities, such as these Gelada baboons, and then plotted out the brain size, which is along the bottom, where they used the size of the neocortex ratio, which is a very good way of predicting or estimating and measuring brain size. And fortunately, we can do that with fossil hominins because we have preserved skulls. And then on the vertical axis, they plot that against the group size. And as you can see, there's a good relationship here. As brains get larger, so too do the group sizes. The upper limit for primates is about 70 such interaction partners in their personal communities, and reflects the conflicting calls on their time budgets, eating, socializing, traveling, and resting. Using the same prediction, for small-brained hominins such as Narikotomi, we come out with a figure of about 104 interaction partners, well above the primate limit. And among large-brained Homo heidelbergensis, ancestor to ourselves in Africa and Neanderthals in Europe, it rises to 126 interaction partners. Homo sapiens, ourselves with larger brains again, has a personal network size of 150, now known in the literature as Dunbar's number, and confirmed by the average social network size for Facebook users. Now, this cross-species comparison forms the basis of the social brain hypothesis, which proposes that our social lives drove encephalization, which is a fancy word for brain growth, and where the selective advantage came from reduced predator pressure. The more people you have, the more you can tell the local carnivores to push off. The result is that we have a brain some three times larger than expected for a primate of our body size. One consequence of larger personal network sizes was that the traditional forms of creating and maintaining bonds by fingertip grooming became too time-consuming. Therefore, by 600,000 years ago, language had evolved to facilitate interaction among a larger number of partners, while at the same time overcoming an important time constraint. And just think about it. If we relied, as the Gelada baboon does, on getting round everybody in your personal network of 50, 60 people by fingertip grooming, there's just about enough time in the day to do that. Increase that number to 120, 150, and you could go around and groom everyone, and I could groom everyone in this room before I was taken away, but it would make us all extremely happy because we like grooming, we like this close personal contact, but we would be neglecting eating and we would be very happy, but we would also starve to death. So we have to come up with some other mechanism for making these interaction networks work. So it's therefore by 600,000 years ago that language had evolved to facilitate interaction among larger numbers of partners while at the same time overcoming that a time constraint. However, this brief excursion into the antiquity of language needs to remember that long before words, there were objects. The earliest stone tools are currently 2.5 million years old and could extend back to 3.3 million years, as cut marks on animal bones hint from the Ethiopian site of Dikika. However, such simple cores and flakes, these stone tools, are never going to make it into an archaeologist's lexicon of symbols. Much later, the Narikotomi boy at 1.5 million years ago was contemporary with developments in stoneworking that saw basalt outcrops and river cobbles nap to produce large cutting tools, some of which display marked symmetry of form, as I showed you. This has led some to argue for a symbolic dimension, but the majority prefer a functional explanation such as better butcher's knives or indicators of reproductive fitness. However, very similar objects were being made almost a million years later by Homo heidelbergensis, one of our ancestors, at that critical time 600,000 years ago. The novelty by this time was the maintenance and containment of fire, a development that added time to the social day, and the common use of tools composed of different materials, stone, wood, and bindings, to produce projectiles. Such composite artifacts, like an afterlife, do not occur in nature. They exist because technology is embodied and so grounded in the mundane practices of social life. Those simple tipped spears, stone-tipped spears, are evidence of a developed hominin imagination that can fashion new identities by making associations. As we relate, so we create. We construct our social lives through close emotional engagement with stuff, materials, and the artifacts fashioned from them. These imaginative identities take the form of four interlinked social practices. The FACE, the face of the extended mind, fragmentation, accumulation, consumption, and enchainment. The point about face in the extended mind lies in the metaphorical experiential basis of these practices. And it's also these four faces, what we do every day with materials. We fragment them, we accumulate them, we consume them, and we use them to link people together, to enchain. This explains why archaeological evidence has such robust, familiar, and repeated patterns that survive for many hundreds of thousands of years, and that take the form of well-structured sets and nets of artifacts, like this necklace. Viewing artifacts as material metaphors provides a common understanding between past and present based on embodied experience. To make such artifacts, stone has to be fragmented, and once fragmented, there is the opportunity to enchain, to create social relationships through simultaneously building sets and nets of artifacts with others across landscapes and deliberately at places. The metaphorical basis of a simple action such as fragmentation is, as John Chapman and Berserker Gaidarska argue, that of metonymy and synecdoche, where parts stand for wholes, as shown in the slide here. To break open an animal carcass to get at the food inside is to fragment the whole. To pass the meat and marrow around the hunters and their families is to enchain them into a set of social relationships. Enchainment and fragmentation simultaneously created sets and nets of material of bones and stones in time and across space. They were augmented by the other relational practices that involve people and things, accumulation and consumption. These are evident at the earliest hominin locales, where materials are little disturbed by erosion and movement. Some of them are even in situ after the lapse of a million years. Now, as a final example of this imaginative face world, I'll give you the example of grog. Not alcohol, but ground up pottery sherds for use as temper to add to the clay to assist in the firing of pots. It makes pots work, otherwise they would just explode in many cases. Now, grog is the only temper that does not occur in nature. It's incorporated into the clay matrix. You take your pot, you break it up, you grind it up, and you put it into the clay that you're making into the next pot. A fragment of an existing pot accumulated as part of a new one. Grog also enchains because the ground-up pot, in many cases, belonged to a dead person. Indeed, the death of a potter, as Judy Stirner shows, often results in her pots being broken and the pieces passed around to serve as the raw material for grog to be ground up. In this way, the generations are reproduced in the manufacture of new pots. in a kind of Van Gennep for the social anthropologists among you, in a Van Gennep cyclical society where the ancestors cycle with you through time in this constant reincorporation of the ancestors into the pots. In this way, the generations are reproduced in the manufacture of new pots contained in a cycle of production and reproduction. And the consumption proceeds because the pot is still a container for liquids and food. The generations are carried forward, an afterlife squeezed into a surrounding clay wall. And when the surface of the pot is decorated, then the ancestor within is protected, wrapped in another level of the face world. Now, what I've done here is brought a little piece of afterlife with you. And here it is. This is a piece of grog-tempered pottery. This is Middle Bronze Age from Wessex. Middle Bronze Age, so it's 1500 BC. So while in Egypt they were making these wonderful papyri of books of the dead, this is what we were doing in the north at the same time. We were making pots, and we were basically including granny in those pots. And so this is the rim of the pot, and this is the body sherd. If you look in here, this is where the grog has been incorporated into the temper, into the clay. So this is the afterlife, is actually here in the clay wall of this pot. And if you look at it here, the little brown spots, this is the grog. These white spots are little bits of the flint. So the landscape of Wessex is also incorporated into this potsherd. And here is the grog itself. So here is granny actually in the pot, ready to recycle. And this pot itself, when it comes to an end, it also has a nice individual touch, because I think you can see here, you can see that these are fingertip impressions. This is where the potter has put her fingernail, and we know it's a potter fingernail because these are extremely small fingers, nails, and they're also extremely well manicured. And they go into the pot here to make this little decoration just below the rim. So there you are. There's the afterlife, and this explains why I'm a prehistorian and not an Egyptologist. Thank you. So moving back then to the afterlife, how does this move us forward? Having seen the afterlife in a sherd of pottery, where can this now take us? Well, for sociologists and anthropologists, 2012 marks the centenary of Durkheim's Elementary Forms of the Religious Life. The central message in his global review was that religious life is not a special, separate activity. It marks neither a transition in human development, for example, from primitive animism to civilized religion, nor requires its own vocabulary and concepts to achieve understanding. Indeed, religious behavior in all its varied ethnographic forms lies firmly rooted in the common practices of social life. To analyze the social is at the same time to understand the religious dimension. Religion is an example of the buzz of the social gathering, what Durkheim calls effervescence, and which provides both an explanation for the assembly of people and the power of association that lingers long after the participants have dispersed. Viewed from that perspective, religious life is an example of amplification, how we amplify the core characters of social life. And at the core of that life lie those bonds between dyads, between mother and child, and between personal interaction. And these bind due to the material and sensory resources available and that lie at the heart of this diagram. For example, food, touch, and the sense of well-being. Closely associated with this core are the aesthetic qualities of materials, their touch, their sense, their luster, and the emotions ascribed to social context. It is around this core that accumulation, consumption, and it is around this core that social life and all other imagined lives are scaffolded. They're built around this, they draw on it. These resources are then available for amplification into the social forms we are familiar with such as kinship, icons, laughter, music, the bricks in this building, and the origins myth and afterlife. And these are basically all social forms which are amplified, which you don't find amongst primates. Chimpanzees don't laugh in the way that President Bush is laughing there. They don't cry. They certainly don't dance like Ann Widdecombe. And they don't make music. They do a little bit of drumming, but it certainly isn't music in the sense of Gareth Malone and the wonderful choirs. And they certainly don't converse. These basics, the common core, have remained constant throughout hominin evolution. But social cognition has changed, as any comparison between primates and humans show. And I would single out one aspect as important, a theory of mind, since this human capacity helps us understand our ability to imagine afterlives. Theory of mind is, as Adam Smith prefigured, an imaginative exercise. It depends on recognizing that another person has a different perspective than you do. In other words, they have a mind. This cognitive capacity appears in children between the ages of 3 and 4 as manifest in the belief for false belief. Before this, there is self-awareness, a capacity shared with several other social animals, including the great apes. Whether great apes such as chimpanzees have false belief and therefore a theory of mind is much debated, as is the importance of language for human mentalizing. The majority view is that chimpanzees don't, and that language is critical for the sorts of mental feats in our theory of mind that we can achieve. Language is how we understand advanced theory of mind with higher levels of social reasoning. For example, the statement, "Peter knew that Sarah wanted to put flowers on Norman's grave because God desired it," has 3 levels of intentionality: knew, wanted, and desired. It shows complex social reasoning, that mentalizing capacity, and the capacity to attribute mental states to others, and goes beyond the child of 5 who is capable of recognizing false belief. However, as cognitive studies of human development show, we don't, as humans, have to wait very long. Jesse Bering and Becky Parker tested 3 age groups of children, 3 to 4-year-olds, 5 to 6s, and 7 to 9-year-olds, to see when they reach the cognitive capacity for symbolic causal reasoning. In other words, the ability to recognize an external agency and that sort of 3rd level of intentionality, as in the statement, "Peter knowing about Sarah." In their study, they told children that a fairy tale person, Princess Alice — it could have been a dead relative, but for obvious reasons was not — would give them a sign if they made the wrong choice about which of 2 boxes contained a ball. The sign was a flashing light, or, dramatically, Princess Alice's picture falling off the wall once the child's hands started to move towards the wrong box. The measure was to see if the child then changed their choice. Only 7-year-old children understood this sign as symbolic of an intention by Princess Alice to communicate. The 4-year-olds, for example, just thought the picture wasn't properly stuck to the wall. Bering and Parker conclude that it's not the capacity to detect agency behind unexpected events that is late developing in humans, but the capacity to see communicative meaning in unexpected events. In short, that imaginative leap that attributes mental states to others, whether they are in this life or an afterlife, real or virtual, animate or inanimate. And not only ascribing mental states, but allowing them the power to affect the lives of the living, as in Princess Alice's picture falling off the wall there. But level 3 intentionality is only the start for humans. Upwards lie the mental gymnastics where we exhibit our real relational skills, as shown here in my colleague John McNabb's analysis of the film of Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep. And this just takes us into the wilder excesses of human theory of mind. And thanks to Mac for this. This is level four and beyond. The first level of intentionality, Howard Hawks, the director, intends that the audience accept that Philip Marlowe suspects that Eddie Mars's wife believes that Vivian Rutledge thinks that Eddie Mars knows that Carmen Stone would think she killed Sean Regan. I mean, it always has been a confusing movie. I now know why, because it's clearly above my intentionality grade. I think I'm there with the child of seven and a seventh order of attention. But it's the point is that it's this unbelievable elaboration of what we can do if we want to. Why then becomes the question. But which hominin ancestors had theory of mind and was in an advanced level? If language is essential, then, as I've already suggested, social reasoning akin to theory of mind could be at least 600,000 years old. The problem for archaeologists is that if they did have that, they're not letting on. The artifact record doesn't change significantly at this time, as we might expect. A bit like Princess Alice's picture falling to the ground to indicate that advanced levels of intentionality were now present. But using the social brain model, Robin Dunbar provocatively suggested that level two intentionality, recognizing another mind, what children of 4 years old can manage, occurs in hominins with brains larger than 500 cubic centimeters, about a third of our size, and which is a value not achieved by chimpanzees. A level three intentionality he associates with brains over 1,000 cubic centimeters, and level four, the sort of Philip Marlowe level and above, over 1,400, which means that we would share that with Neanderthals. The critical link is between larger group size requiring novel forms of interaction such as language and the link between language and higher order intentionality. But what if artifacts and materials, the archaeologists' bread and butter, are not reliable signs to such a fundamental change in the way that our ancestors conceived the world? What if another element in that social core, emotion, is a better guide? Remember the core of emotions and materials. Well, the problem there is that emotions don't preserve very well either. Moreover, they're extremely slippery things to define. When does anger pass into rage or satisfaction into contentment? We could have a long discussion about that. However, emotions can be usefully classed into three large families. At the base are mood emotions that are felt at places. They appeal to geographers in particular, and about things and people. Then there are primary emotions, which all animals have for good survival reasons: fear, happiness, disgust, anger. Finally, there are the social emotions, which depend on a theory of mind, recognizing another's point of view. These include guilt, shame, and pride. Now, some animals are thought to have a sense of guilt, usually the family dog after it has eaten the family's dinner. But that's something else. I put it to you, would the wolf, the dog's ancestor, would the wolf feel guilt if it ate Little Red Riding Hood in the forest? I don't think so. The family dog shows us that materials can be trained to feel as another facet of domestication. A dog, by virtue of being taught emotional responses, is an amplified material resource. It's an amplified artifact, which perhaps explains why many women prefer talking to them rather than their partner. So 600,000 years ago, artifacts didn't need to change to record that theory of mind had appeared, but the emotional basis of social life certainly did. Social reasoning of at least three orders of intentionality probably existed, and moral codes in the form of social emotions like guilt and shame now structured hominin society. So I'm coming to my conclusion. Where does this leave the afterlife as an imagined geography in our deep history? I would draw a distinction between the afterlife and the afterperson. The former, the afterlife, as we saw with the Book of the Dead at the beginning, is, or with my pottery sherd here, is a personal imagined journey into the unknown. Others will take the same road, but the private aspect of that journey is what matters here. The latter, the afterperson, is about the continuity of social cognition across the same living, dead boundary. Here it's not so much about what will happen to us, but what happened to those who preceded us. And here with my hominins, I'm just putting it up here, here's posing the question 600,000 years ago, is Fred with us? Fred is a deceased hominin, and the answers come back, I can sense him, he's in my hand because he's holding a material artifact that may have been made by Fred. Ask a different question, ask an afterlife question, where's Fred? And my argument would be that we get a blank, you know, what kind of a question is that? First, the afterperson. Let's deal with that. Bering argues that continuity in mental states is the default position for human cognition, and it's counterintuitive to deny it. What is interesting from his psychological study is that even among the most hardline afterperson skeptics, what he calls in this graph the extinctivists, I suppose Richard Dawkins would be one of those, and the agnostics, that's the yellow line and this line, they're the ones who say that there's no biological, psychobiological, or perceptual continuity across this division, but a number of them, up to 20% or so, actually say that there is still continuity in emotional desire and other psychological aspects. So some aspects of the individual carry on across this boundary into the world of being the afterperson. So the afterperson skeptics claim that there's some support for the mental states of emotion, desire, and knowledge continue after death. On the contrast, the skeptics also find common ground with the afterperson believers, such as the immortalists and reincarnationists, that the biological, psychological, and perceptual characteristics of a person do not persist across that same frontier. What then is the evolutionary advantage of letting our imaginations run riot with such higher order intentionality applied to after persons? The question becomes one of adaptation. Is the after person an unintended consequence of advanced theory of mind, or are they an adaptive mechanism serving a wider evolutionary goal? One suggestion is that such continuity was a mechanism for hypervigilance. That rustle in the bushes is more likely the sign of a leopard than the benevolent breeze. It's the falling picture of Princess Alice. Or is it because we cannot cope with the cognitive void implied by the elimination of mental states? We simply cannot imagine being without emotion, desire, and knowledge, so that in our memories, the dead must also have those attributes. From there, it's a short mental step to believing that supernatural beings, the top dogs in the afterlife, can send signs of displeasure if the living break the social contract. These signs take the form of famine, flood, and earthquake, or whatever events apply to your locality or culture. In short, 600,000 years ago, afterpersons were the moral guardians, the netherworld police, for those bigger social groups indicated by larger hominin brain sizes. And since the mechanism to amplify the bonds that bound these people together was weighted towards the emotional rather than material side of that social core, we should not be surprised that social emotions, underpinned by advanced theory of mind, united living and after persons. But that still leaves the afterlife. If after persons are about continuity, and this goes way back into our ancestry, albeit a bit disembodied, that continuity, then the afterlife is a response to going beyond. For example, the ability to materially represent an afterlife and an afterperson are present in the grog-tempered piece of pottery. But we can do better than such recent examples. Without the ability for social extension made possible by our distributed cognition and our means of application through materials via FACE under evolutionary pressure, we would be a very different species. Most notably, our expansion from being an old world resident, where we set up home for 6 million years, to becoming a global settler in only the last 50,000 years of our evolution, has been as dramatic as the rise of cities, numeracy, literacy, and civilizations. Worldwide humans came long before the World Wide Web. This capacity to expand and to do it so recently and become a global species is one of Homo sapiens' greatest achievements. Other developments were needed. The technology of boats, the flexible container of kinship, the ability to accumulate and store food and so defeat seasonality. But there was also, I would argue, an imaginary geography of somewhere to go, as well as the continuity of invisible action. The afterlife is a parallel projection of that global itinerary, a journey accomplished by mobile peoples who lived at low population densities, fishing, gathering, and hunting, but equipped with the means to think ahead, materially through the metaphors of containers and instruments, linguistically through signs and symbols, and emotionally able to react to the challenge. The afterlife, but not the afterperson, began with those first footsteps out of the old world 50,000 years ago and into Australia, into the Americas, into the Pacific, and ending up in 1969 on the moon. And those first footsteps 50,000 years ago, beyond the boundaries of the hominin world and into the virtual and real worlds of humans, those imaginary geographies that we now peopled for real. And why? Because, as Jack Kerouac put it in On the Road in 1957, there was nowhere to go but everywhere. Thank you very much.
Well, what a wonderful account of the emergence of human beings and the human thinking in society being enabled by metaphorical containers. I'm particularly keen on the grog bit, and I realize that my career as an academic has been spent recycling old ideas and old articles in new pots as a sort of academic grog. And being about to retire, I realized that my afterlife will be embodied as little bits of grog, if I'm lucky, in other people's probably also unread articles. I thought that was a wonderful lecture and a wonderful account of how we might conceive the life beyond that which we experience directly. Thank you very much indeed.